So the second part is going to be more about what the book's about in terms of what religion has become. Who is left is what we're going to talk about today. Who's still in the church building? Who's showing up every Sunday? So I wanted to start by thinking about
God. God bless all you.
Yeah, God bless all of you for being here on a Saturday morning. I don't know if I'd go to watch anybody talk on Saturday morning. Maybe I would. I don't know. Hopefully, I want to make it worth your time. I'll just say that. I want you guys to leave here and feel like that was a good use of my 2.5 hours. So, a thought experiment. If you think about your church, I want you to think about what percentage of people have earned a four-year college degree, have no more than a high school diploma, earned more than $100,000, earned less than $50,000. Are people of color? Are women? Voted for Donald Trump in 2020. We always love asking pastors what the political partisanship of their congregation is. One day I'm going to do a really big survey where I ask pastors to guess, and I'm going to just survey the congregation to try to figure out how far the pastors are, not knowing the answer to that question. Are not currently married among those 30 plus, have never had children, and are single parents. What the data is showing us more and more is that religion has become a very specific thing for a very specific group of people, and it's not inviting to everyone. Churches are not diverse like they used to be. Now, church has never been good at being racially diverse. Let's be honest here, okay? That's always been a blind spot for the church. Martin Luther King Jr. said the most segregated hour in America is 11 a.m. on a Sunday morning. I think it's becoming less true, actually, because if you look at a lot of these mega churches, they are actually fairly racially diverse. Now, the smaller churches are not, but the bigger churches are the ones growing. So, I think we are getting better on that. So, who is actually going to church now? The data challenges a lot of assumptions about what religion looks like in the United States in 2024. I think there's a lot of perceptions that religion looks like that, right? And a whole lot more data that looks like that. By the way, AI created both those. Let's not have that discussion today. We don't have time for it. But I do love it to make pictures. They make nice pictures. This is an assumption that a lot of people have about religion. And I think it's because they read too much Karl Marx in college. Karl Marx did not like religion. Do you guys know that? Not a huge fan. But the perception that religion is, it's for snake handlers, right? It's for hillbillies. It's for backwater folks. It's for the poor, the uneducated, the underclass. It's, forgive me, Sky Daddy, for I have done a no-no. And I have an automatic rule on Twitter. If someone refers to God as Sky Daddy, automatic block. No quarter for me. It's like, we want to be respectful of everyone, but you believe in fairy tales and Sky Daddy. So, no, blocked. Okay? Most Americans still believe in Sky Daddy, by the way, about 90%, according to polling. So, religion is how simple, uneducated people cope with a world they can't understand. Okay, that's an interesting perspective. Don't share it, but fine. So there was a book that came out in 2004 called What's the Matter with Kansas? Anybody read this book? One person!
My wife's great aunt.
Is she really? That explains it. So it's actually a really interesting book, and the reason I put it up here is because I went to grad school in religion and politics in 2005. And this book was published in 2004, and it was like everybody wanted to talk about this book when I was in grad school and the implications. So here's like the 30-second synopsis of what Thomas Frank argues. He grew up in Kansas, but it used to be a left-leaning place, right? Bleeding Kansas. Eugene Debs, the socialist, had his newspaper in Topeka, had 100,000 readers of a socialist newspaper in Kansas around 1900. He leaves, goes to college, comes back, and it's deep red. He's like, what happened? What's the matter with Kansas, right? Like, what happened to Kansas? And so his thesis is basically the Republican Party went into Kansas and convinced a bunch of uneducated, poor evangelicals to vote for them on abortion and gay marriage when really all Republicans want to do is cut tax on rich people. Like, that's the thesis of the book, is the Republican Party duped evangelicals. And that's why they all switched. Now, the fun addendum to that is a really famous political scientist named Larry Bartels wrote a paper called What's the Matter with What's the Matter with Kansas, showing empirically that everything that Thomas Frank argued was completely wrong. No one read that paper. Everyone read the book, right? Saying like, look, the dumb evangelicals can be swayed by the Republican Party. No, they were actually becoming more educated and having higher incomes, and they wanted lower taxes because that's what happens when you get education and income. So it's not like a we got duped thing. But it kind of goes back to the idea, like, look how dumb Christians are. They can just be swayed by anything and everything. You know, Karl Marx said that religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, the soul of souls conditions. It is the opium of the people. You guys heard this before? Of course you have. I was like, guys, I'm going to teach you about Karl Marx. Please don't tell your parents right now. I'm not trying to make you communist. I'm just trying to make you cultured. Because Karl Marx thought religion was a tool of oppression. Like, that's really what he thought it was, because he looked around and saw the bourgeoisie basically using religion to keep the proletariat in their workplace and happy in their work by saying, God wants you to do this. God is your destiny. And if you look at the American South during the 1830s, 1840s, slave masters would view the Bible as a weapon to keep slaves in line, saying, slaves obey your masters as to the Lord and not unto men. Let me ice quote the Bible to you. How about that? Huh? You're getting it all today. And they didn't let them read. They didn't teach them how to read because they would read the other parts of the Bible, talking about, things like liberation and freedom and all that cool stuff. Marx never saw liberation theology. I think that was his major problem. He never saw what happened in Central and South America when a lot of religious people used their belief in God to throw off their dictatorships. Or the civil rights movement in America when a lot of leaders of that movement used God as a justification for trying to, create the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. He only saw the bad parts of religion. There are absolutely good parts of religion. So, this understanding of religion is very oppressive, very negative, very downtrodden. And then you've got this whole idea of like college, it leads people away from their faith. Oh, gosh. If I get asked, that's like a question I get asked about the most, guys, like among my evangelical, what school should I send my kids to so they don't become heathens? And I'm like, I don't know. Any of them are fine. Maybe not Wheaton. I don't know. I say that because I've spoken to Wheaton 3 times, so leave me alone. What really kills my cause is this movie that came out maybe 15 years ago called God's Not Dead. Anybody watch that one? Yeah, it's got Kevin Sorbo in it. Remember he was Hercules back in the day? So he's an atheist college professor teaching philosophy, wearing the elbow patches, as you do. And the hero of the story is a guy, a young college student, 18-year-old kid, grew up in a Christian home, obviously. His last name, and I'm not even joking, is Wheaton. Go look it up. Like, could you not be more on the nose than that, right? And so the conceit of the movie is you can't pass Introduction to Philosophy unless you sign a pledge at the end that says that God is dead. Which is the dumbest premise ever, okay? Like, I have been on college campuses my entire, for 25 years now. And at worst, I get indifference towards religion. Most of my colleagues are actually religious themselves, if not at least open to the idea of religion as a concept in Americans' lives. So it's just a ridiculous concept. They would never allow that. Anyway, so the end of the movie, he has, like, the fight with his girlfriend, da 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 da. At the end of the movie, you have to have it's finals day, and you got to sign the pledge and get an A or not. So Wheaton stands up and has this big speech about, God's not dead, and I know God exists, and everyone goes, yay, well. And they all walk out, and they don't sign the pledge, and Kevin Sorbo looks all sad. That's a good synopsis, right? So that movie was made for, like, $2 million, made $65 million at the box office. They have now made 3 sequels. God is not dead or dead, dead. The 4th. God's still not dead. But the whole idea of the movie is like that education is antithetical to religion. Like that's the trope that it relies on. And can I just say that's wrong? Like demonstrably, statistically incorrect. And that no one hears that. So let me show you that. This is a share of people who identify as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. And I broke it down. This is 15 waves of the survey. By the way, the total sample size of this survey is like 750,000. So, big sample. And this is education across the bottom. So no high school on the far left, and then postgraduate degree on the far right. This is a share of people who identify as nuns. You see which way the line goes? It goes down. The people who are the most likely to identify as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular are those people without a high school diploma And the people who are the least likely to be atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular are those with a postgraduate degree. How about that? The nuns aren't full of uneducated people. It's actually the opposite. Yes, sir?
Postgraduate to the right?
Yep, postgraduate here, high school diploma here. Every single one. Now, you do see the number of nuns is rising overall. You know, that's, we know that. But the slope is continuing the same way. And actually, there's some evidence actually might be getting bigger, the gap, the education-religion gap over time. So the educated are leaving religion at a slower pace than the lower-educated people are. So Kevin Sorbo's wrong on this. And that's not the only metric. This is a survey of 477,000 people, and I like this one because it breaks down postgraduate into different categories. So you can even see like what kind of postgraduate degree you have. And you can see the people here, most likely be nuns, are those with a high school degree or less. And then it goes down, 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 down. The people in this survey who are the least likely to be non-religious are those with a master's degree. Bet you didn't know that. 1 in 5. Only 1 in 5. It means 80% of people with a master's degree are religious. It's only 68% of people who didn't graduate high school. And then it does go up for people with doctorates, which that's 1% of the population. I am the 1%, Bernie Sanders. The Madison crowd gets that. The other crowds don't get that one so much. I feel like you've been watching a little Bernie Sanders, huh? Somebody got to say, the 1% of the 1%, like it says like that. 24% of people with a four-year college degree are nuns. It's 24% of people with doctorates. You see what's going on here? Like, this is not just like one survey. Talking about 16 surveys, over a million respondents. The consistent finding you see is education makes you more likely to be religious, not less likely to be religious. And let's do attendance too. This might be even more striking in a lot of ways. Because now the line goes the opposite direction. Instead of going down, it goes up. This is share attending weekly or more. And again, I broke it down. These are people no high school on the far left and people postgraduate degree on the far right. And you see it every time. And these are big gaps too, guys, like 10, 12-point gaps from the bottom to the top. I mean, the people that are the most likely to be religious and the most likely to attend church every week are people with graduate degrees. I just don't know why that has not gotten in the bloodstream American society. Like I gave this talk at Asbury last week, which is a Christian school down in Kentucky, Wilmore, Kentucky. And I had a student come up to me after I gave a version of this talk and go, I feel so affirmed by you because I thought I couldn't have a college degree and still be a Christian. And I was like, oh no. We've ruined you somehow. Like, who hurt you? Tell me and I'll go talk to them. You know, it's this idea like the Christians are dumb. No. It's the opposite. It's actually the uneducated, which we're going to talk about in a minute because I think it's problematic. But the thing that should be affirming to a lot of you is like send your kid to college. You know? Send them. And the data says, I'm going to put this up here, but I got some data from, they did a religious knowledge battery of college students. So like ask them questions about different, like, who's Dorothy Day? Right? Or like, what day did Jesus resurrect from the dead? You know, stuff like that. And about Islam, about every religion. The Christian students who scored higher on that knowledge battery were more likely to be religious when they graduated than those who scored lower on it. You know what that tells you? Learning about other religions does not make you more likely to believe your own religion. It makes you less likely. It's almost like we shouldn't be sheltering the kids. Maybe we should be teaching them about other faiths, because then they go to college and go, all I know is evangelical Christianity. Wait a minute. What's this other way to think about things? You know, like maybe like work them up. Like my first semester at Greenville, went to Greenville College in Greenville, Illinois. Best thing I ever did, they took us to Chicago, big city Chicago, a little small town kid, go big city. We got to go to like 6 different religious sites when we were there. We got to participate in worship with them. Right, so we went to a holy name cathedral downtown Chicago. Got to worship there. I'd never been to a Catholic church in my life. Then we went to an Episcopal church, and I got served communion by a female gay priest. Don't tell my grandma. And it was wine. I never had alcohol before. I was like, what? I didn't like it, though. It tasted bad. We went to a Jewish synagogue, went to an Islamic mosque, went to the Baha'i temple, went to a black Catholic church called St. Benedict the African on the south side of Chicago, which is the weirdest mashup of Pentecostalism and Catholicism you've ever seen in your life. But I left that going, wow, I will never understand American religion, but I want to know more. You know, it affirmed my faith. It didn't destroy it. It actually, in some ways, was the most formative thing that ever happened to me, because now I walk into any church, any house of worship, and I feel comfortable there. You know, it doesn't feel strange to me. It feels like, okay, you express your beliefs differently than I do, but I still find God here and there and over there, you know? I just think we should do that for everybody. We should have like a tour in America, sending people to different sites, saying, listen, learn about other religions. And that's what education does. It opens your minds to the idea there's other ways to think. And I will say, I went into Greenville believing a whole lot of things very little, and I left believing a few things a whole lot. And that was a very formative moment for me. My dogma is very small. Used to be, my dogma was huge. Now I believe very few things. I believe a whole lot. So, here's a regression. Any statisticians in the office here today? Okay, we'll skip it then. Just to show you, this is the relationship between attending religious services nearly every week and education. You can see what's happening. The lines are always going up. 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000. Now, in 2010s, it sort of flattens out a little bit, but it's still going positive, right? So still positive, still positive, still positive, still positive. And here's another one. Again, same thing. I'm just trying to show you, like, I've tested this a bunch of different ways. This is not just some weird, like, I found one thing. No, no, no. It shows up over and over and over again in the data. The more educated you are, even if you control for age and partisanship and race and gender and income, the more educated you are, the more likely you are to go to church. More, not less. More. So, that's different. Right, that's something we don't know about. And now let's add income to the picture. So this is household income. That's what's down here on the x-axis. And then I broke it down into college degree. That's the orange. And then high school or less. That's the blue. Okay. Now I love, like, look at this one, and look at this one, and look at this one. You see how it's in this one too, but it kind of messes up here because you don't have a whole lot of really high earning high school or less people. So throw that one off. But you see what the lines look like? Like this. We call that curvilinear. So high in the middle and low on the sides, like a rainbow shape. So here's the relationship. Always the orange line is above the blue line, by the way, which means we just talked about this. College degree means more likely to go to church than people without a college degree. So that's a fact. But then if we add education in the mix, what's the right combination of income and education that lead to church attendance? The answer is not the poorest, okay, those making less than $10,000, and not the richest, right in the middle. Between $60,000 and $100,000 a year. That's the magic combination of factors. College degree, middle class income. Not the highest of the high, not the lowest of the low, people right in the middle of the income distribution. That's what American religion looks like. In 2024, middle-income people, four-year college degree. That's the combination of factors. Now, let's add marriage to the equation. So, what I did was, I broke this down by age. That's what's over here. Okay. So, really, you got two lines. I have three lines here. It really should be two lines, because this line looks almost exactly like that line. So, really, it's married versus not married. That's the dividing line, okay? So amongst younger people in their 20s, the difference is not that tremendous. But look here at like around 30 years old. That's right here. Amongst married 30-year-olds, about a third of them are attending church every week. Amongst unmarried 30-year-olds, it's about 16%. So a 30-year-old who is married is twice as likely to attend church every week as one who is unmarried, divorced, separated, never been married. It's that stark. And that persists, by the way. Now, it does get a little bit smaller. But even amongst 50-year-olds, the gap is, what, 16 points versus about 10-point gap here. It's a persistent gap in the data that especially balloons out like in the 30s, where married people are way more likely to be in church than non-married. You see the picture that's beginning to like bubble up right now? College degree, decent income, married. Okay? Check, check, check. That is what's happening here. And then let's add kids to the mix. Okay? So again, same X, which is H, right here. I broke it down into four categories. Married, not a parent, is the blue line. Okay? Married and a parent, red line. And then not married, not a parent, that's the yellow line. And not married and a parent, green line. Okay? Now, I want to point out that the lowest line consistently are the blue and the yellow. Or I'm sorry, the green and the yellow, which are not married. We just talked about that. But look here. Look, trace this blue line with me. This is single, or I'm sorry, married childless. That's what the blue line is, married childless. See how it goes up because you get a bonus for being married when it comes to church attendance through your mid-20s. But then if you're in your late 20s and don't have kids, look what happens to your attendance. Begins to go down. So getting married is like, okay, I checked that box. Let's cruise along to get to like 28 years old. I don't have any kids. Oh, wow, I probably shouldn't be going to church anymore. You see what's happening here? It's like you have these like checkpoints in your life. And if you don't check all the boxes when you get to that age, you fall off. The path gets more and more narrow every year you age, and you have to continue to check more and more boxes. When you're 18, you've got no box to check. By 22 or 23, you better have a college degree, check that box. Then you better have middle income, check that box. Then you better be married by 27 or 28, check that box. You better have kids by 30, check that box. And if you don't, you're not coming. You're not here. So look at like, for instance, look here. This is like 35 years old. This is married with children, and that is married without children. 35% of married parents are going to church at 35 years old. It's about 18% of those who are married but don't have kids. Twice as likely. Twice as likely. So married makes you twice as likely to go versus non-married, but married with children is like an additional oomph to the attendance thing. Yeah. Ooh, that's a good question. I have not. Let me write that down. But I would venture to guess it probably wouldn't matter. It would matter some, but not a tremendous amount, but I'd have to check. I'll make sure my sample's big enough, too. Yeah, Bob.
So married plus parent, it looks like it trends down. Is that because the kids get confirmed, they get out of the house, and then
their
parents stop going?
Part of it is the question's asked, are you currently the parent or guardian of a child under the age of 18? So people are aging out of being a parent in that, you know what I mean, that approximation. So I don't know how much of that is that versus the other thing. That's why like I have a lot more confidence. That's why I cut it off at 52 and didn't let it go all the way down the end. Because most people are going to have kids out of the house by, you know, 50 years old.
What's your pool?
This sample is 147,000.
Individuals.
Yep, individuals, correct. And then let's collect between 2020 and 2022. I know you're going to say COVID, and I'm going to say people answer the same question during COVID they did before COVID because they didn't answer how much they're actually going. They answer how much they would go if they could. That's like a big thing with the survey. We didn't change the way we asked survey questions. We asked them exactly the same way because it didn't change how people. Because what they would say is, "Well, I know church is closed, but if it was open, I would go." Like that's what they. That's basically how they answered. If you look at the trend lines, it didn't change that much. So, how about this? What percentage of you regularly meet with other members of the congregation outside of the weekend religious service? How many of you stay for 15 minutes after the worship service ends to chat with other members? To me, that's where church happens, by the way. I strongly dislike when the janitor's like, let me turn the lights off because I got to get home. No. You should pay the janitor an extra hour to keep the lights on as long as people want to be on. Now, I really think you should think about this strategically, too, from an organizational standpoint, logistically. Having Sunday school after church means that people have to go somewhere after the church is over. You know what I mean? Like, churches create space for relationships to build. And that is that pastors, I know there's a few here, you matter a whole lot less than people think you do. Politics is not inculcated from the pulpit, by the way. We know that for a fact. You know where it's inculcated at? In meetings like this, when you guys talk between each other. Let that conversation happen. Okay, that's where the church is built. That's where you build relationships. I remember when we had little kids, we had no chance to talk to anybody because our kids were like 2 or 3. They're running around. They couldn't go to restaurants because they like jump off the table. And we'd be those parents. You know what I mean? So we just didn't know. But in the church, they could run around the pews and jump off the thing. And you know what I mean? As I talked to other young families, like it was a safe place for us to have relationships with people. And you can't forget that. You know? Do you actually show up early? You know? I think, like, the people who show up, like, at 9:29 for 9:30 services, literally as soon as the last song's playing, they're like, rah, out the door. Like, you're missing the point. You're missing the point. The service is important, don't get me wrong, but, like, the before and the after are probably more important. And you're skipping that. No. Hang around. Give people space. Maybe play a little music in the background, you know, on a little, like a low level, so they got a little background. You know what I'm talking about? Create opportunities for mixing, for relationships to build, to plan dinners and lunches and babysitting, you know, all that stuff. That's where church can be found. Here's why does all this matter?
So the GSS has been asking people since 1972,
do you think other people can be trusted or that you can't be too careful in dealing with people? So it's called interpersonal trust. It's probably one of the most important facets of functioning democracy because if you can't trust other people, then we got trouble. Okay? Do you believe that like the average person is going to punch you in the face and steal all your stuff? That's a rough way to go through life, right? And for a long time, the more people went to church, the more trusting they were of their fellow men. But look what happened in the 2010s. That line began to point downward in the 2010s. Now, more frequent churchgoers are less trusting than those who don't go to church. And that's bad. That's really, really bad. Here's you can see it in a regression here, so I control for stuff. It actually pops even more when you control for stuff. So, like, you see, like, the 70s, church attendance drives trust. 80s, same thing. 90s, same thing. The 2000s, same thing. But look what we have here in the 2010s. Now the line goes downward. More people go to church, the less trusting they are of their fellow man. And that's bad. And I guess the question I would have is, well, why? You know, like, why is this? Why do we trust people less? Well, how about this? This is the trusting graph broken down by education in all these decades. So, guess who trusts people the least educationally? People without a high school diploma. Guess who trusts people the most? Those with a college degree. And that gap has actually gotten larger over time. It was 32 points, and now it's almost 40 points between the trust from the bottom to the top. So now people, 77% of people with a high school diploma or less now say you can't be too careful in dealing with people. Almost 80% of people with a high school diploma say other people cannot be trusted. 80%. It was 60%, which wasn't good. But 80% is a whole lot worse. Think about that. We've got a whole... By the way, most people don't have college degrees. And those people are walking around going, I can't trust you. I can't trust you. I can't be too careful in dealing with you. 80% of those people say that now. But guess who? Guess who's in church, though? Not those people. The college degree people are there. And you know where people learn trust from? By being around other people, and they earn that trust over time. But if you're not surrounding yourself with people who you can learn to trust over time, what's going to happen? The natural inclination, which we just talked about, right, is your mind slips into, I can't trust people. I need to be suspicious of people. Church teaches you the opposite of that, that people are good. They want to help. They want to serve. They want to be good. And what's happening is, educationally, the church is becoming a whole lot of people who are high trust. Now, I will say causally this is really hard because does education drive up trust? Or do people who are more trusting get higher degrees of education? Right? I think it's a little bit of both. You know, like, if I don't trust anybody, I ain't going to college. Because imagine having a roommate I don't know. Professors, I don't know. Administrators, I don't know. That's scary, right? But I do tell my students all the time, I say the most important lessons you learn in college are not in this classroom. It's dealing with the registrar, dealing with your advisor, dealing with your roommate, dealing with, you know what I mean? That's where you learn stuff about how to navigate difficult situations in life. And if you don't go, then what do you, you know, where do you learn those skills at? Well, church used to be a place to learn those skills. And now you're not. So, this is a question about, has a doctor or other health provider ever told you you have a mental health condition? And this, notice the dates on this too, by the way. That's during COVID, like right at the beginning of lockdowns for COVID, okay? So, you can see a couple things here that I want to point out. One is that liberals are more likely to be diagnosed with mental health conditions than conservatives. There's a methodological problem with this because we know that liberals are more likely to seek out mental health counseling compared to conservatives. That's a fact, okay? I'll show you the graph in a second, though, that makes me go, I don't know if that's the whole story. But notice a couple things. So liberals always score higher, like literally at every level of religious attendance. But you notice what the trend line looks like here? The more you go to church, the less likely you are to say you've ever been diagnosed with a mental health condition. Now, how about this? This is a series of questions. This is, again, right during COVID, okay? Have you ever, how often in the past 7 days have you felt depressed, felt lonely, felt anxious or on edge? This is the share saying at least most days you felt those things. What you can see here is, again, liberals score higher. They have more emotional distress. But the more people went to church before COVID, the less likely they were to say they felt anxious, depressed, or lonely. This is a consistent finding in the data, is that religious attendance drives down mental illness, mental disparities, mental struggles. And it's hard causally to like figure out what's doing that, but the data is pretty clear on this, and I've tested this many different ways, at many different angles, controlling for different stuff, and it's just hard to suck out this idea that going to church increases your mental health. It just does. And that's hard to tell young people, especially who have never gone to church, you know? And do I think, by the way, do I think it's because Jesus heals your mental health problems? No. Can he? Sure, I believe in that. Why not? But you know what I also think is really good for people? Being around other people. And so when I tell the atheist community, they look at this and go, why are you pushing church on people? And I said, I'm not pushing church on people. You know what I'm pushing on people? Going to a place where other people hang out. That's what I'm pushing. And, you know, I did talk at the Secular Coalition of America, which is always funny because the Q&A time is a little combative. And they say, you know, you used to say that religion is a good thing. Do you still believe that? And I say, yeah, I think it's a good thing. Because here's the thing. Religion causes us to come together in places like this. I think that's a good thing. Now, if the atheist community would create their own space to do things like that, I'd be all in favor of it. But to this point, they have not done that. And unless and until they do that, my position holds that meeting together with people who are different than you is good for you, period, full stop. And church provides that. Well, less and less. But it used to provide that for lots and lots of people, and it helps with mental health. So, here's another way that religion helps. There's this great paper that was published 2 years ago now by Raj Chetty, who I think is probably the greatest living economist. He's at Harvard. So there's this concept called economic mobility, which is your ability to move up the economic spectrum, right? So go from lower class to middle class to upper class. The number one predictor of economic mobility is being in economically diverse spaces, okay? So, question is, where do you find economic diversity? They analyzed 72 million people, age 25 to 44. Thanks, Zuckerberg, for giving your data away to Ross J so we can learn these things. Here's what they found. Americans are more likely to befriend someone of a different social class in a religious setting than in their neighborhood, in high school, at work, or even in college. The data shows unequivocally that the place poor kids and rich kids are most likely to become friends is at church. What are your neighborhoods based on? How much money you got, right? What's your school's based on? Your neighborhood, which is based on how much money you get. What about your workplace? Blue-collar people tend to work with See how this is all shaken out here? One of the very last spaces in American life where you find real economic diversity is in church. Rather than being yet another arena in which to compete, religious spaces instead cultivate an ethic of camaraderie.
So even if you were in an economically diverse workplace, it's like, well, I got to get these promotions so you don't get it.
I got to move up so you don't move up, right? It's competition. In church, it's not competition, it's camaraderie. Right? It's almost like we're the perfect engines for economic diversity in the world. Right? Almost like we're designed in a special way to create this benefit. Gordon Allport, has anyone read Gordon Allport in this room? Oh, man, I thought a Madison crowd would be the one to like, yeah, I love Gordon Allport. So Gordon Allport wrote a book about 50 years ago called The Nature of Prejudice, which is a huge text in psychology about what generates feelings of prejudice and how to mitigate those feelings of prejudice. And his findings are so incredibly important for the church. He created a theory called social contact theory. Okay? So what social contact theory says is that intergroup contact under, and I underline this, appropriate conditions can reduce prejudice between majority and minority group members. Appropriate conditions, right? So that's not at the Los Angeles Dodgers baseball game. Not an appropriate condition, right? Appropriate condition. What are appropriate conditions? Here's what he outlines. Equal status among group members. Common goals that highlight interdependence. A focus on cooperation, not competition. And support of authorities, laws, or customs. Guess what church checks on those boxes? All four of them. It's almost like church was designed to do good things for all of us, not just religious people. So when we talk about the death of polite religion, which is the death of a lot of mainline churches, this is what we've lost. When do people from different educational backgrounds, economic backgrounds, political backgrounds actually hang out on a regular basis? It used to be church, and church used to provide a social contact theory which reduced our prejudice because we were under appropriate conditions to find people who were different than us as not enemies, but friends. And now we don't have that for two reasons. One, church has declined rapidly. And two, church has become all the same people. And that's so even what we're left with is not generating these engines of economic diversity and social contact theory and social capital that we used to have. We're not getting the same net benefits because church has become so much of the same thing. You know, there's a great paper my buddy Paul Jupe wrote where he looked at, actually he surveyed ELCA congregations, and he found that churches are a great place for people to learn civic skills. Civic skills. When I walked into my first faculty meeting at EIU, we did Robert's Rules of Order with, you know, first and seconds and all that stuff, and I was like, I can second that motion. And someone goes, it's your first meeting. How do you know how to do that? You know how I know how to do that? I grew up in a Southern Baptist church that used Robert's Rules until I was 5 years old. I knew how to, you know what I mean? I knew how to set up and make a motion. I knew how to first and second and a call for a vote and all that stuff because I grew up in a church. We did those things. Fundraising. You know where you learn how to fundraise oftentimes? In a church. You know how to set up a campaign? Like to do something in the community? In a church. Organize a meeting. Organize a rally. Guess where you learn a lot of that skill? In a church. And you know where that benefits you? Everywhere else in the rest of your life. Right? It's almost like the church does good things you don't even think about. Like it's almost like invisible to us. And his paper is really interesting because you know who he finds who benefits the most from that civic skill generation? Those are the bottom end of the socioeconomic spectrum. Because they don't get it anywhere else. They're engines of civic skill development. The data says, you know who's most politically involved? People who attend church more frequently than those who don't. Getting involved in one thing gets you involved in many things. Right? There's so much data out there that shows the positive value of religion. John Rockefeller was a good American Baptist. I didn't get any cheers from that. He was a good American Baptist, though. He was the richest man in the world about 120 years ago, right? Worth $100 billion. And Rockefeller, when he got to his rich, that's his church, by the way. You could have a Baptist church in Cleveland, Ohio. They tore it down. It's actually a parking lot now, which is a real travesty in my estimation. But he actually paid off, his last financial transaction he ever did in his life was pay off the mortgage of the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church. And then they tore it down. I don't know. I don't understand all the ins and outs of that. Anyway, by the way, when he got rich, you know what all his friends told him? John, you got to become an Episcopalian because you're rich. And he goes, no, I'm a Baptist. That's who I am. It's in my guts. He grew up in a really rural community in New York and then moved to Ohio and just, you know, grew up hardscrabble his entire life and really came up from his dad was a huckster, was a traveling salesman, a magician, weird guy, got rich on oil, right? Never left his Baptist heritage. Actually went to church, you know, but before he was famous several times a week, when he was famous, the only time he left his house was to go to work and to go to church. That was it. Because he would be mobbed by the press anytime he left his house. But, you know, he was asked, why do you go through all the struggle and hassle of getting out of your house to go to church? And the church retained many blue-collar members, enabling Rockefeller to chat amiably with a blacksmith or a mechanic. Such everyday experiences eluded him as he withdrew behind the high gates of his estate. Rockefeller never got a chance to talk to a blue-collar worker except when he sat in the pew on Sunday morning. That was the value of church. You sat next to people who were different than you, and you realized, wow, they're not bad, they're just different, and that's okay. And different's not bad, different's okay. We've lost that because the church has largely become the bastion of educated, upper middle class, parents, children, right, married. That's the combination. We don't have this diversity that we used to have in these congregations, and I think it's killing us. I think it's hurting the church. Because the way I understand the gospel, and I'm no theologian, was that Jesus was always interested in the people on the outside of society, on the fringes of society. You know, there's this famous verse in the gospel of Luke, the last will be first, and the first will be last in the kingdom of heaven. You guys are aware of this? Yeah. It's in the scriptures, I think. Maybe. I'm trying not to commit any heresy, so let me know if I do. Just a lay preacher. But you know who's not coming to church? The people on the fringes. You know? The people who are coming are people who did everything right, quote-unquote, in life. The people who don't are not there. And I think we're worse for it as religious people, but democracy is worse for it because we're not getting social contact theory. We're not getting civic skill generation. We're not getting all the positive benefits, this economic diversity that we used to see. We're not getting political diversity either. That's a problem. When you have a whole bunch of churches, and I'll say it right now, if you get upset, you should get upset. If you ever see a pastor get in the pulpit with a MAGA hat, you should be mad at that. Then I saw a picture of a woman pastor in maybe one of the denominations we just talked about with a Planned Parenthood logo on her stole. I'm not okay with that either, guys. I'm not okay with that. And I will say that in a group that probably is a little different politically than what I usually talk to. It's not okay, right? Political diversity is what the church should be. You should sit next to Bob who votes for Trump. Not you, Bob. Theoretical Bob. Theoretical Bob. When Steve votes for Biden. Because you know what you realize? That next to a guy who votes for someone differently than you, he still loves his family. He still loves his church. He still works hard for his community. He really is a good person. He just happens to have different political beliefs than what I hold. You know? And I had a conversation with pastors this week. They said, well, how do I talk about politics? And what I said to them is just simply this. You need to tell people what's in bounds and what's out of bounds. And I'll tell you what's out of bounds. If you say that every Trump voter is a racist, that's out of bounds. And if you say that every Biden voter is a baby killer, that's out of bounds. You get what I'm saying here? You got to stop demonizing the other side. The problem is, in church, you used to know people from the other side, but now you don't because it's all one stripe or the other stripe. And that is bad. That's caustic for American democracy. It's caustic for our soul. Because what you do if you don't know someone from a different group is create the worst version of them in your minds and then hate that version of them. People are way more complicated than that. Okay? That's what I've realized. It's really easy to demonize a group I don't understand. Social contact theory says the more I come in contact with people who are different than me, the more tolerance I have for those differences. You know? That's the problem we're facing with. So, I used to go to a liturgical church when I was in college. It was called St. Paul Free Methodist Church. I was 19 or 20. It was a great church because it was like a teaching church. You know, they have teaching hospitals. It was a teaching church because a lot of the seniors would preach there like once a semester. So it was a rotating pulpit with like professor on first Sunday, student on second Sunday, professor on third Sunday. It was cool because you never know what you're going to get. And sometimes it was great, and sometimes it was not so great. You know what I mean? Don't listen to my first sermon ever. It was awful. I thought it was so good though, and then I look back and go, ugh. So, liturgical church, which I love, I got in late that day, and I sat near the back, and then I turned around maybe 2 minutes after the service starts, and this young couple walks in. They're younger than me, and I'm in college, 18, 19 years old. A man and a woman, she's got a baby on her hip. I don't know if they're married, girlfriend, boyfriend, I don't know what the situation is. So we go through church, we do our whole thing, you know, all the liturgical things. We get to prayers of the people. You guys do prayers of the people here at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church?
Yeah.
I love it. Love prayers of the people, right? I loved having this talk with like a Baptist group. You're like, what is that? I don't know what that is. We don't do prayers of the people here. But, you know, so the pastor, you know, stands up and reads a prayer about the denomination, the country, the leaders, the world, peace, all that kind of good stuff. And it opens up the congregation, right? And you hear the typical stuff like, my Aunt Sue has cancer. Could you pray for her? And we all, and the pastor says, Lord, your mercy. And we all say,
your prayer.
Oh, I love that. That's so nice. It feels good, right? Doesn't it decide to do that? Because it's like, in this moment, I'm pulling for you. You know? Like, that just feels good. That just feels like we're community building when we do that. And so it's the typical thing, you know, Barb's got cancer, pray for her. We're traveling to Florida this week, pray for us, you know, Lord have mercy, hear our prayer, all that kind of stuff. And then, right before he's going to close up shop and go on to the next part, this kid behind me, God bless him, had the courage to say, could you all pray for me? I lost my job, and I don't know if I can pay the rent at the end of the month. And, you know, Pastor says, Lord have mercy, we all say, hear our prayer, like you typically do. And you go on to the next part, because we're liturgical, so you got the next part, you know what I mean? You got to just keep plowing through. That's God's design. So I'll say, the lectionary is God's design, huh? That's cute. Anyone who preaches the lectionary knows what I'm talking about. Get those sons like, what are you thinking with these passages? Let's do a thematic sermon this week. I'll pick my own passage. I've done that before. And so we do the thing, you know, they do the homily, and as soon as the service is over, an older gentleman in the front turns around and walks straight to the back to next to that kid who said that thing. He goes, son, I own the lumber yard in town. If you want a job, you can have one tomorrow. Right? Like, isn't that it? Like, isn't that, if the church has become a place of just upper middle class, married people with children, you lose that. And that, God works in mysterious ways, doesn't he? It's almost like if you speak a need into a community of people who have been trained to meet needs of people, they will meet the needs of the people. We need that. Like that, to me, you can theologically argue with young people all day long, and I don't. Because Philip Yancey once said, no one became a Christian because they lost the argument. But you know why people would come back? Because when they needed help, someone helped them. What a crazy idea. What a crazy idea. Is it spiritual? Yeah, but it's also very social at the same time, right? God works in mysterious ways. I believe in the spiritualness of church, but I also believe in just the social aspect of what religion is. I always joke with people, I don't need AAA because I have ABC USA. If my car breaks down in some random town, you know, the first thing I'm going to do is pull out the old Google, look for American Baptist Church where I'm at and call the pastor. I'm going to have four people show up with new tires for me and some ladies with casserole dishes if I hang around long enough. Ready to get me back on my way. Because you know what I would do? I'd do the exact same for someone who's in that situation if they broke down in Mount Vernon, Illinois. That's what church is. That's what church is supposed to be, at least as far as I understand it. And the problem is, if we become all one thing, we don't have people who have needs. You get what I mean here? It's all people wanting to give, but no place to give. You need both. You need the giver and the givee, right? You need the recipient, you need the person, you need the kid in the back and the guy in the front. And unfortunately, what's happened is more and more those kids in the back aren't coming anymore because they don't. I don't think the church is like, you don't belong here because you don't have a college. They're not doing that. You know what I mean? But somehow that's seeping into the groundwater. And people are getting the idea of, well, I'm a single mother, don't belong. Got divorced, don't belong. Never got married, don't belong. Right? Don't have a college degree, don't belong. Don't have good income, don't belong. And church becomes all one thing, and we don't see couples like that show up anymore. So, here's what I want you to think about. As a congregation, go back to your congregation and think about this. Think about how many social events do you attend where the people there come from a variety of backgrounds. Right? I think one of the biggest problems we're facing in America is what we call a third space problem. First space is your home. Second space is your work. What's your third space? What's your third space? It used to be the Elks or the Moose or the Kiwanis or the Legion or the Boy Scouts or, you know, pick, right? There's plenty of third spaces for people to hang out with. Now there's none of those things. Church is one of the last remaining third spaces on earth, As we talked about, do people there from non-morality backgrounds? The answer is no, they don't. Right? Be intentional about seeking out social spaces that are diverse in many ways. Oh, that goes against everything. No. I'm not going there. You should. Because you know what's going to teach you? That people are not bad. They're just different. And different is not bad. It's just different. Find a space that's different than yours. Go hang out with a crowd that's different than yours. If you're a part of a church, how diverse is that community and how can you make it more diverse? What are ways to seek out? By the way, when I say diverse, oftentimes our mind goes immediately to like racial diversity, and that does absolutely matter. The main line is absolutely terrible at that, by the way. But it's beyond that. It's economic diversity. It's class diversity. It's educational diversity. It's all kinds of diversity. Finding people that are different than you and getting them to come to church is the best thing you ever do. So what I've been telling churches is, I want you to set aside a portion of your budget for completely social events. Not like, we're going to have a barbecue, and then there's going to be we're going to have an evangelistic sermon. No. No praise bands. No. You know what you should do? We're going to have a barbecue. How long is it going to last? As long as it lasts. Yeah. Right? As long as it lasts. As long as people want to hang out. You know what you should do? You got space here at Good Shepherd Lutheran, I've noticed, for people to meet, hang out, have a meal. Potluck, that's great. Love potluck. Young families, bring your kids. They can run around and jump off stuff. We don't care. Create space for them to hang out. You get what I'm saying here? Like, just create space without any sort of preconditions or notions that it's going. We got to hand them a contact card. No, you don't. No, you don't. You know what your motive is in doing all that? Serving your community. That's it. That's your motivation. My church, First Baptist Church of Mount Vernon, Illinois, about 12 years ago, I read this thing that I could not shake by Rob Bell. You guys know who Rob Bell is? Rob Bell. I'm a big fan of Rob Bell. He got a little weird recently, but I'm a big fan of Rob Bell today. I've gotten a little weird recently, too, to be honest. I'm sorry. He said, if your church closes down, would anyone outside your membership really care? And that hit me like a ton of bricks. Because at that point, I knew that no one would, except our members would really care, and their families, right? That would be it. So we started a program called Brown Bag Friday. My kids go to the public school. 84% of kids in my kids' public school are on free or reduced lunch. One of the poorest districts in the state. And we were being told by social workers the kids would come to school on Monday hungry because they wouldn't be fed all week. And I was like, you know what we should do? Feed hungry kids. Like, pretty hard to argue with that, right? Like, that's about as basic as it gets. So we started packing these bags. 13 items in the bag. Banana, apple, water, Pop-Tart, crackers, just stuff, right? Eat ready to eat stuff. They can eat over the weekend, come back. We started by doing 30 bags a week. Me and Banana Man Bob Miller passed away a couple years ago. He was such a wonderful supporter of the program. And we thought we weren't going to have enough money. We ended up doing the program for 12 years. We'd spent over $100,000 packing brown bags for these kids. Never ran out of money. Not even close. We actually went from 30 to 60. Then we went to the school and went, how many kids need the bags? They go, 117. We go, got it. 117 next week. Then we added another school. Then we added another school. We're doing 225 bags every week, a congregation with 12 people. 225 bags. We serve so many kids. So many kids. And here's, we had this fight at the beginning. Like, what do we put in the bag? I go, food. They go, no. What do we put in the bag? I go, food. They go, no, we got to put something in the bag. Okay, cool. They go, let's put tracts in the bag. No, we're not doing that. We put a little slip in the bag that said, we're First Baptist Church, we don't know you, but we love you, enjoy the food, if you need anything, call us. That was our compromise. Almost lost my job over that compromise, but I did it anyway. I just wanted them to know we loved them, and that's it, right? So, 1 year, in October, we got a call from a grandmother. The bag went to her grandson, which is happening a lot in our community. Grandparents are raising children because of drugs and all these other things. It was getting cold, and she said, I can't afford a coat for my son. Do you have a coat? And it just so happened, God works in mysterious ways, that we were having a rummage sale in our fellowship hall and had racks and racks of clothes. And we said, come on down, take whatever you want. She came in, brought her little grandson, he's about 8 years old. They filled up three big garbage bags full of clothes for her and for him. And I never got his name. and they're real her name, and I don't care what their names are. I hope that kid becomes Billy Graham someday, by the way. So I can be like, I did that. But more than anything else, what I hope is that he will be sitting at a bar when he's 25 and someone says something mean about religion, and he goes, no, that's not it. Because they gave me a coat and food when I didn't have either. Isn't that the ballgame? Isn't that the ballgame? Like in a world where the nuns are rising and religion's under attack and all these things, all we can do is what we can do, right? Be the church. Do your job. Serve the community. Love others. Build space. Build time. Build possibility. And then let God show up. That's all we can do. There's the parable of the sower. You know, the Bible, they throw the seed. A lot more of it's falling on rocky ground than ever before. I'm completely convinced of that. But you know what? That does not tell us we cannot throw seed anymore. Our job is to throw the seed. Where it lands is God's problem, not ours. So my encouragement to you guys is throw as much seed as you possibly can for as long as you possibly can and hope God shows up. And I think he will. So thanks. There's the PR slide that my guy that they didn't want me to do. So, real quick though, a couple things. I have a Substack called Graphs About Religion. You can go sign up on Graphs About Religion. Graphs About Religion. Google that and get me, okay? Because guess what's on that website?
Graphs.
About? Religion. Thank you. Good. I was like, that's great branding. I'm like, I know, genius. I just had a stroke of genius that night. Also, I work for a group called Faith Facts, which is based out of Washington, D.C. It's a nonprofit interdenominational group that basically my job is just to show people the value of religion. You hear so many bad stories, it's my job to show you a good story or two about, hey, a new paper came out that shows that this religion does this thing, and just make it accessible to the general audience. So you can follow us at Faith Facts.
Are you open for questions?
Absolutely. Hit me with a question.
Somebody. Okay, bye. Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm not a member of this church.
Okay, out. Leave now. Wait, is that the right thing to do, Eric? Okay, sorry.
You should know that this church does what you were just talking about.
Yeah. God bless you. Yeah.
They do as good a job as anybody
else. God bless you. Now, when someone who's not in your church says that, it means you must really be doing it. And that's all you can do, right? Just be the church. Build the kingdom. People are like, you kingdom? No. The kingdom. You know what I mean? The kingdom. We need more of that. Not about power, right? Not about who wins elections. Not about any of that stuff. That's not what the kingdom is. And part of my job is I talk to a lot of media folks, and like part of my job is with the evangelical whisper. It's like, what's this kingdom of God stuff? I'm like, calm down. That ain't it. Like, I know you're looking for a story. That's not the story. People use that language. I use that language. I don't mean it the way you think it's coming out, right? Build a kingdom. Yeah, go ahead.
When I was young, I had a physics professor, or physics teacher in high school.
Yeah, yeah.
And not this church. And anyway, his son had needed a heart transplant.
Yeah.
He was in Atlanta, and the church is in northern Wisconsin. And he asked the church to respond to that, and he didn't get any response. And people thought, well, why should I go to church then? What's all that about? Are they hypocrites or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
How should I respond to all of that, to that kind of situation?
Say that church is not being a hand and feet of Jesus Christ. Pretty simple. I mean, that's a failure on the part of religion, I think. I think we got to call out, when people don't do things I think are not indicative of what Christ's kingdom's about, then we need to be clear about that. You know, say, listen, religion's a lot like manure. You have, you guys heard this analogy before? You put it in one place, it starts to stink, but if you spread it all around, it can do some good. You like that? You can use that before. I don't know who told me that. But I think that's a situation where, like, if religious people only want to serve religious people, like, that's a primary problem. You know what I mean? Like, are you one of us or not? You know, like, who cares if you're one of us? You know what? You're all one of us because you're created in the image and likeness of God. You know, I don't care if you're from our country or not, or a Christian or not, or you vote for the same person. I don't care. Imago Dei says that every human being is born in the image of likeness of God. Every human being. And by the way, it also means that we should care about the immigrant. We should also care about the unborn, too. Ooh, that hurts, doesn't it? But the Christian message is bigger than that, right? It should transcend party. You know, Lincoln said we shouldn't ask if God's on our side. We should ask, we're on God's side. Yes. You know, like, are we doing? And I get real fired up when I hear like, you can't be a Christian and vote for X. Are you kidding me? Like, that's the nonsense black and white language that got us into this mess in the first place. You know, you stop that nonsense. Just stop it. That's not, just because they vote for someone that you disagree with doesn't make them an awful person on either side. They might have a different calculation than you do, and that's okay. The question is, are they a human being? And the answer is yes. They deserve your respect. That's it. It's the end of the conversation. Yeah. Back corner.
The non-denominational graph.
Yeah, yeah.
The one that's up.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a little flavor to the people who are finding and making that home? Is that an on-ramp for the unchurched?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it the people who are exiting other established churches but checking it out before they finally exit church altogether?
Yes, the question is, how are non-denominationals growing? Good question. Okay, so here's what we know. A lot of them, there's a lot more churn in non-denominationals than other religious traditions, which means more people come in, more people come out. So it's a very volatile religious environment. Okay? What we also know is that most people who go to those churches leave another evangelical church to go to those churches. So it's like one click of like Southern Baptist to non-denom. That's a big pipeline. There's also a reasonable pipeline from Catholic to non-denominational. Like 10%-ish, I've seen different data. What we know is theologically they're almost always evangelical, though. We almost like just by default call them evangelical churches because good luck finding a mainline non-denom church. They exist, but they're, you know, probably less than 10% of all. These churches are basically Southern Baptist without the baggage, is what I call them. And I think I'll... Okay, so here's the real problem. I've gone to a lot of these churches, non-denom churches, are growing fast. And go, can I survey your members? And they're like, yeah, sure. And I'll email and follow up and go, no, not really. Because you know what they're terrified of finding out? What percentage of their members were attending, not attending another church before or attending another church before? Because what they're really doing is cannibalizing other denominations. I don't think they're adding to the water in the bathtub. They're just swirling it around. And I know at my church that's been the case. A lot of people left my church and went to the non-denom church down the road. So what I think, the average church size in America, by the way, is about 70. A lot of really small churches. I think the worst size a church could be is like that medium size, 150 to 250, because it's like you got just enough money for like one staff, but you probably need two staff and you can't afford it. But you're a little big, but not, you know what I mean? You don't know what you are. You're like, a little too big, a little too small, not enough. What we're going to see in the future is the number of churches in America is going to go down. But the size of the average church is going to go up. Because it's like mergers and acquisitions, right? It's almost like consolidation in the market. And listen, I'm honest with people. I go, you look at my church, it's 12 people, all old. You bring your young family there, we got nothing for you. You go to the non-denom on the road, they got a children's pastor, they got a youth pastor, they got a kids zone, they got concerts, they got all this stuff. And so what churches are realizing is there's economies of scale and being big. And so I think that's how those churches are winning, is by, once you get above a certain level, it's like you get like escape velocity and you just keep going. Because you can hire new staff, you can build more facilities, you can do all these things. And I think they're kind of like self-perpetuating at some point. So that's why I think the future looks like a lot of large non-denominational churches that are growing fast, and a whole bunch of really small churches that are sort of like hanging on until the end comes, either financially or attendance-wise, and not very many churches in that middle band between those two groups. Yeah.
So these non-denominational churches,
yeah,
how do they find clerical staff? What is their pipeline for that? And I think of many of them as cult of personality.
Oh, yeah.
You get one good person,
mm-hmm.
and then that person leaves because they die, do something bad, or find a better job, and then the church is basically done.
They are.
You see that in Madison.
Yes, that's very much the non-denom handover to the second generation is problematic. Very few of them do it well. Bill Hybels in Willow Creek is a great example. You guys know Willow Creek Church?
Yeah.
Growing, doing well. Bill Hybels, like, I'm going to retire. I've got a whole plan. There's like a 3-year plan to replace him. And they actually hired a man and a woman to replace him, so like co-lead pastors of the church, which is a big deal because they were like evangelical and they had a female pastor. Like, whoa, what are you doing? Anyway, come to find out, Bill Hybels had been had a sexual relationship with one of his staff members for a long time and kept it quiet. And the board knew about it and also covered it up. And they got in a huge problem. And now the church is like a third the size it was because of all his mess-ups. It doesn't go well. So where do they get their staff from? I always joke that Southern Baptist, the non-denoms should be writing a check for Southern Baptist for their seminary bills. Because they're basically just subsidizing non-denom. They're subsidizing the group that is pulling people away from their denomination. Like, if you, I would love to do a survey of non-denominational pastors who have seminary degrees and ask them where they got them from. I bet the vast majority are from Southern Baptist seminaries. That's where they're being raised up and trained up. And again, theologically, they're almost exactly Southern Baptist, most of them. There's really not that much difference. And part of that is Southern Baptists really don't have a strong polity anyway. It's all local church. So it's like one click away from being non-denominational. So I think it's why they're paying people to draw people away from their church. But you can't make them stay Southern Baptists once they graduate. Like, that's not how seminary works. So they can do whatever they want. Yeah?
If they're ecumenical, you know, we've got a smaller generation coming up.
Yeah.
The baby boomers are all dying off.
Mm-hmm.
That's creating a lot of the problems that we have today. Is there anything ecumenically that some of the churches are doing to try to address it?
No. Ecumenically, denominations don't get along. I don't know if you knew that or not. there's a reason we're different than they are, is why I was here. But necessity drives a lot of change. And I am hopeful that the seven sisters will become four sisters, figuring out where we can agree and where we can disagree. And so, you know, I think it would forestall a lot of the really hard conversations by doing that. But, I mean, honestly, when our church got really small, we contacted other churches. Do you want to merge with us? Nope. I mean, just blanket conversation. Nope. And so it's really hard to do that. So I think that at some level, I'm hopeful that we'll find an ecumenical solution to these problems, but everyone's kind of like they're doing their own thing, good, bad, or indifferent, and it might drive them to the end. Yeah.
I have a question. Like, the demographics, we're going to wind up probably like Denmark or Europe.
Yeah.
What kind of problems is Europe having, or did they replace religion with something else so they have the socialization and things you're talking about?
Yeah. So Denmark's the happiest country on earth. Like, statistically, it's the happiest country ever. But here's what no one tells you about Denmark. It's also 90% white Lutherans. That's the problem. We can't replicate the Denmark model, because what the data says consistently is, if you ask people on surveys, are you willing to pay more taxes? The answer is yes, if it goes to people like me. So we're not going to get to the welfare state that Denmark has because we're so racially diverse. So we can't follow that path. So they're very social in Denmark. They actually pay you to start social clubs in Denmark. They're trying to replace religion with these social clubs. I don't think we're going to look like that, because we're just not culturally like that. We're also way more individualistic in America than Scandinavians ever thought about being. You know, my favorite example of that is during the Obamacare debates of 2008. One of the guys, they're at a town hall, and one guy was in the front in a wheelchair, and he says, I need help paying for my medicine. And a guy in the back stand yells, how's that my problem? Like, that's America in a nutshell, right? Like, your problems are your problems, and my problems are my problems. So I don't think we're ever going to get to that, like, communitarian world. The problem is, there is no country in Western Europe that is like that culturally. So I don't know where we end up. I think we're going to be more religious than most Western European countries in the next 50 years, maybe not demonstrably more, but we're also going to be more isolated, more individualistic. I don't know. On a bad day, I feel like democracy is not going to endure very much longer. But yes, ma'am.
I'm one of the pastors here at Good Shepherd. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I wanted to speak to Judy, the lovely woman in the pink sweater, that Madison is a really unique Christian community, and that we do have ecumenical efforts that are moving forward. And there's actually some studies involved in what's happening here through different university projects, the university in particular. And so I find that super interesting that maybe that's not happening in other places,
no.
But it is happening here. And I hope you all at Good Shepherd are aware of those efforts. And if you're also just in the Madison community, there's something called the Collaboration Project, which is a great Christian organization that brings together evangelical, mainline, and Catholic, whoever wants to join, to work for the community, doing service projects and getting clergy together. And there's other efforts like that happening here in this place. And I really am hopeful because of that, because I think really the future of Christianity involves us working together for the good of the kingdom, whether we do have those differences or not. The other thing I want to say is I found your information really interesting. Do you have other information about women in ministry? I think in particular, that is something that I'm really interested in knowing about.
I do! So I wrote an article. I know, actually, I didn't write a book on that. I don't. So there is a book on that called She Preaches the Word, though, by Ben Nall and Cammie Boland, which is really good. But I wrote an article. We surveyed people, asked, you know, would you... assuming they're qualified, would you be okay with a woman in the following roles? Teaching Sunday school, leading a women's retreat, preaching behind the pulpit on Sunday morning. 75% of evangelicals said yes to the preaching behind the pulpit on a Sunday morning thing. And Pew Research Center just released a poll last week of Catholics. 2/3 of Catholics would be fine with female priests. That makes me... So I published that data, and the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary just railed me. Like, this cannot be true! And I'm like, it is, though! Why are you so bad at convincing your people that the pastor told me for men? And they've not been able to do that. That's... Can I give you... give me 30 seconds. The book that I'm writing, that this is kind of based on, it's about religious polarization. So what we talk about the ecumenical thing. That got me thinking. So we're losing the middle of American religion, the polite religion part, which is places like the ELCA, right? The mainline, we're like, yeah, you got to believe in Jesus, but it's better to serve the community, love people, and y'all come, and it's fine. Now, in the future, what we're going to see is polarization, right? So a whole bunch of people on this end, a whole bunch of people on this end. The right is going to be full of white evangelicals, traditional Catholics, which are growing rapidly right now, by the way. There's people who reject Vatican II, who believe that the Mass should be in Latin, right? That was the failure of the church. The church became too easy. That's why people stopped going, which is a theory, of course. People have thoughts. Latter-day Saints, Muslims, Orthodox Jews, right? And Dearborn, Michigan, they had a fight over book bans. The people who stood up in line were evangelical Christians. You know, stood right behind them? Muslims. Because we disagree on those things, but we agree on these things. Right, so what we're going to see is a band of, they're going to realize we're better together, right? We can fight politically if we're all banned on this side. And you know what's going to be the other side? A whole bunch of nuns. And nobody in the middle. And that's bad. It's bad for democracy. It's bad for our country. This polarization is going to kill us because now we don't know people. Now we snipe people from one side or the other. It's hurting us economically. It's hurting us socially. It's hurting us politically. It's hurting us in every possible way. So I say the death of polite religion. They want to change the title of the book, by the way, to the Big Church Sword, which, okay, fine. I think the death of polite religion has more bite to it, though, because I think that's exactly what's happening, is we're losing the people in the middle who would go to church, but not that kind of church. And now, in the future, all you're going to have is that kind of church. And those people are going to be lost, and we're going to be worse for it. So, I'll stop. It's noon. I'm done. Bye. I know.
Thanks again to Dr. Burge for joining us this morning. You might wonder, okay, so I've been soaking up so much these last 3 hours together. Facts, figures, studies, everything's firing. Where am I going to go from here? Well, hopefully you can check me on this because I'm about to drop a stat. You can say,
oh boy,
false or not. LifeWay did a study that said if you invite a friend to church, there's an 82% chance they would go. If they were invited by a friend, average person says, if my friend just invited me, 82% of them would be likely to go to church. But just 3% of people invite a friend to go to church. So, tomorrow's Sunday. It's an opportunity for an invitation. Worst they can say is no.
Think Eric getting all preachy on you right there.
Think about, and maybe it's next Sunday, but think about inviting a friend to church. The other one is, okay, where can I find that third space? Where do they exist? Well, guess what? On your table, on the way out, this is the summer ministry catalog, and there's a whole host of third spaces. Write down June 3rd, Monday, June 3rd. Music Monday starts. That's when we get neighbors together for a concert, for a meal. Anybody can come because it's pay what you can. There's great music. And all you do is have a meal together.
Yeah.
That's fun.
That's good.
There you go.
More of this, please.
June 5th, we have the Meadowood communities coming together for the anti-violence meal. We got the barbecue. That's in the parking lot. Come here. Bring a friend. There's bingo nights.
Bingo!
Bingo! There's trivia. It's all in here, and there's more stuff. Also, you're literally surrounded by opportunities to get involved. The clothes closet over here on Thursdays, giving coats and clothes and everything like that. The food pantry behind you. But both of those things exist because decades ago, somebody thought we could be doing something different. So right now, there's something that doesn't exist, but maybe it starts here. Maybe the need you see, you invite, you bring together, and because of what you heard today, because we saw it today, the next generation starts to get plugged in. You don't know. You don't have to start something new either. You can get involved with what's already here. But something from today, right? It's not just a thought experiment today. Something from today. Something in your notes, something that's happening. It doesn't stop here with it. That was fascinating. That was challenging. It doesn't stop here. We thank you for being here today. Thank you for taking the time. And thank you again to Dr. Bird.
Pray? What do we do?
Would you plug this in
for me? Oh,
right. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Thank you.
You guys want to pray with me once?
That'll be fun. Dear Lord, we thank you for this lovely group of people who met together on this Saturday morning to learn about the history of American religion and maybe the future. I pray that they would be encouraged, edified, inspired, and equipped to go into the world and be the hands and feet of Jesus Christ. Find the lost, the least, the last, the lonely, the left out. Show them the goodness and grace that we have through our relationship with Jesus Christ. Please allow them to build the kingdom of God wherever they go, whoever they're with. And may the community of Madison, Wisconsin, and the entire world be more and more like Christ's kingdom every day. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Go in peace to love and serve your neighbors.
Thank you.